quickly say that this is a continuation of the interview with Cal Kramer on September the 18th.
The subsidy for agriculture was to protect agriculture and keep it as a business in the United States for the benefit of the consumer or the people in the United States. And just as the subsidy to the railroads were and to the airlines. And so you really got to understand what the subsidy is all about. And you know, right now in agriculture, they're really backing off of this, the subsidy in crops, because the economy in it is quite high. But you know, we on this farm really didn't like the subsidy thing. There was enough money in it that kept us in there signing up. But we tried to be very careful that we did not become a slave of the federal government because of the subsidy. And I think we did pretty good at it, never letting the federal government get an economic hold on this farm.
Uh-huh.
And that's the problem that I see with the subsidy, is whose slave are you going to be?
Uh-huh. So if you become too reliant on it, then then you wind up being under the control of the federal bureaucracy, huh?
Right. And of course, there's a lot of subsidies going around, and that's what they have to be called right now, for clean water. And of course, you can call them a subsidy, or you can call them the carrot to encourage people to participate in those programs and those practices. And or you can look at it and that, okay, they passed the law, they ought to be able to, they should give me some dollars to do it then.
Mm-hmm. So there are some dollars available. Is that
what, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually, earlier when we first started talking about the politics of water and farming here, I had started off with the tack of wanting to also find out a little bit about your personal relationships with political figures, and we've talked about the congressional delegation, and they made comments about various members there, but I was going to ask you a little bit more about your relationship with Governor Attia and maybe other governors, which I didn't pursue at that point. But so maybe now, you said you didn't interact with Hatfield when he was governor, but then let's see, after Hatfield was
McCall,
McCall, and then it was Straub after that, I guess.
Yes.
Right. And so what about Governor McCall?
I didn't have too much to do with Governor McCall. And of course, he was the governor and had to sign the legislation for land use planning, and which I believe I was involved in the legislation of that.
And you mentioned, of course, in one of the interviews, your opinion of L.B. Day, who is McCall's sort of right-hand man in terms of the environmental.
Yes. And, of course, I ended up in 1972, I started going, delivering products to the co-op. And of course, you know, L.B. Day was the head of the union for the co-ops. Those people all belonged to his union. And I remember the day when he declared a strike against our co-op, and I remember the day that he had to eat those words.
Okay. I was thinking of, why don't we pick it up right at this point. Can you tell me a little bit about that then? Tell me the story.
Well, yeah, we tried to make those contracts come due the first of the year when processing wasn't involved, but they would drag their feet and mess around with it.
Now you're talking in terms of their contracts with who specifically?
With the processing plants, and there was a separate contract with every processor,
Having to do with wages?
Where their wages for the employees.
I see. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they would drag their feet and try and get that backed off until it was around the 1st of June or the 1st of July. And then they figured they had the power then to go ahead and call a strike, and that would make the processor come around real quick, because that's when they were processing their products. And when he did that with NORPAC about 6 years ago, I believe, we were prepared for him, and we moved our families into those plants and started operating them without his employees. We broke the strike in about 3 or 4 days.
Now you're talking about just 6 years ago, you mean?
Yeah.
And now, so Day was at that time the representative for the workers. I mean, the head of their union.
Yes. And that was about. He died a year or two after that.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so. Like literally, you moved in with your families into the plants?
Yep. They had been not trained so much, but they had been primed for what they were going to have to do, and they went in as bosses, and the strike breakers came in and did the work, and we never lost a day.
Uh-huh. What kind of... organization did you have to go through to get that off the ground? To get the
well, it was done all ahead of the strike.
Uh-huh.
And of course, those companies, well, the bosses, the higher bosses are not part of the union. And of course, it's their job to negotiate those contracts with the union.
Uh-huh.
And so it was under their leadership that even though the plant was owned by the growers, well, they were working for the growers.
And so it was the managers of these plants then that, mm-hmm. that sort of organized the effort to recruit the
yes.
the force of strikebreakers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so that was your run-in with Day in much more recent times, but back in the era of Tom McCall's governorship. Now you. I think you said you'd had some run-ins with Day, and we talked about that.
I didn't have any directly with him, but I was concerned about how he was implementing the land use program.
Mm-hmm. And you said you didn't have much interaction with McCall either? Is that
no,
right?
I didn't.
Okay. Any other people in his administration that come to mind that you might have?
No.
Okay. And then after McCall, of course, we had Governor Straub.
Yeah.
And what was your experience with the Straub administration?
Well, I didn't have too much directly with the governor, but his natural resources assistant, which was Janet McClellan, Governor Straub's idea and hers that they were going to have a large natural resources agency, and all the smaller agencies were going to come under that, kind of like the Human Resources Department in the state of Oregon. Uh-huh. And we were very successful in discouraging that whole effort, because it had to be legislated, and they didn't do their homework properly with the right people. and we were part of the right people that they didn't do their homework with.
I see. So
and so we were very effective, and that legislation never even got off the ground.
Uh-huh. And now, had they done their homework with you, do you think it might have turned out differently? Or would their homework have convinced them not to go ahead with it?
Yeah, I think it had convinced them not to go ahead with it.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, but I'll have to admit that under the TIA administration, well, TIA called me in his office one time, and I was then president of the conservation districts in the state. And those of you that remember that in Atiyah's time, well, in the state there wasn't very much money. Every agency was short, and tax collections was down. And so he informed me that the conservation division agency in the state of Oregon was up to be cut, eliminated.
Oh, totally cut, huh?
Yeah. And he said there's only one way it can survive, and that is to be put under another agency. And he told me the agency was of our choice. And so I had to go back to the conservation people in the state of Oregon, and we sat down, and of course it's not much fun to lose your identity and have to become under another agency, but that's what we did. And we selected to go with the Department of Ag, but we could have gone with DEQ or something like that too.
Uh-huh. And why did you choose agriculture? Just because that seemed like the most logical place, or?
It was more acceptable by the people who were implementing conservation in the state of Oregon. And really the federal government had really, their priorities were basically with agriculture. Not totally, but generally.
Uh-huh. So you thought it might be, there might be more political clout there?
Even though we knew that the Department of Ag in the state of Oregon was a consumer group, it still sounded better.
A consumer group, what do you mean by that?
Well, most of the regulatory responsibility of the Department of Ag is consumer protection.
Uh-huh, I see.
Yeah.
So not a group that is closely allied with farmers' interests necessarily then?
No. Marketing has become an interest in the department, but I still question that program as being a government program.
Uh-huh.
And so but that's the only one that really is to promote agriculture in the state of Oregon. Practically all the others is just to be sure that the food is clean and healthy.
Uh-huh. And you said that you knew Atiyah personally.
Yes.
Does that relationship endure to this day, or?
We're on a first name basis yet, and I see him maybe once every two or three years, and probably won't see him no more. I ended up getting somewhat involved in the Republican Party, and I would see him on occasion that way.
Uh-huh.
But now that I'm retired and out of this, well, I'm trying to leave politics go.
Uh-huh. So you were involved here with the local Republican Party organization?
Yeah, with the county, yes.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things, was it always on an official basis that you spent time with Atiyah then? Or did you socialize with him?
Occasionally we were at a dinner together.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Let me just pause here for a second. So you were just saying that as we were sitting here discussing our plan for our next session, you were saying that would like to talk a little bit more about the irrigation district. So, and the comment you just made wasn't on the tape, so why don't you go start from there?
Okay, well, our irrigation project is one of the most modern, most sophisticated, and one of the neatest operations in the United States. And it's kind of looked at as the model for those things that are coming and going to be repaired or updated. And of course, the beauty of it is that that any farmer can hook on to the pipeline system, which we've got over 100 miles of pipeline in the county, and without a pump or the use of any energy on his part, can irrigate his crops. And practically everywhere else in the United States, you either got to hook a pump on or use a pump, or it's a flood system where you flood your field with water and you control it that way.
Which is the older system that existed here, I guess.
No, we never had a flood system here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
I thought some of your own farm had.
Okay, we had, yes, we had that, but we never, we used a, instead of a flood system, we were using a underground system, and we just filled the soil up to about 8 inches from the top with water and left it that way, where the systems that I'm speaking of now is running water over the surface of the ground.
I see. Okay, I see. Yeah.
And the system in Washington County still operates. There's still a pump that's involved, and it's with that pump plant, and that pump plant pumps the water 300 feet up this hill, and of course it then with gravity, well, we have 150 pounds of static pressure on that pipeline. And
this is the pump system that you went back to Washington to get money for, is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
So this, why don't you tell me a little bit about where that, is that pump just right at the reservoir then? Or?
No, that pump, we release the water out of the reservoir and pick it up down the river on Spring Hill Road.
Okay.
And it's pumped to a reservoir up on the hill, a tank, and it's all automated. When the guy out at North Plains turns his valve on to use water, it automatically kicks the pump on here because of the reduction of water that he has created in that tank. And it automatically turns the pump on, and that pump then keeps that tank full.
Uh-huh.
And as more farmers turn their valves on, well, more pumps are turned on. And that pump plant is capable of, somewhere around 140 cubic feet per second, which is a lot of water. And so that is the beauty of that system, is that it's always available. And that system is available year-round, because you don't want to drain the water lines, otherwise they'll float in the wintertime, because our water level sometimes is over the top of the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so consequently, that is, the water is there year-round if it would wanted to be used. And right now the policy of the district is to shut it off every fall and turn it back on in the spring, but they do that at the individual boxes.
Uh-huh. So the water's still there.
Still, water is still there, and it's always available for firefighting, and the pumps are still on. Usually they terminate all but one or two of the pumps, so that if there happens to be a line of any size that would break, well, it wouldn't turn all the pumps on in the plant, because it would probably pick up a house and wash it away.
Uh-huh. there's that much water available.
Yes, there's that much water available.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more automation that's possible, and of course with anything this automatic, well, there's naturally some problems with maintenance and operation, and being able to, if there's a breakdown, how to bypass it and keep everything going. It really only takes less than an hour to drain that tank usually, and by the rule it's supposed to take 24 hours to fill it back up. And so if you're in the middle of the summer and that breaks down, well, you've got everybody shut down for 24 hours, which is a long time when you need water in the summertime.
Uh-huh. So that's one of the drawbacks then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went back to get the money for this, you mentioned that it's a unique system in the United States. Maybe not totally unique, but at least, you know, very unusual. Was that recognized? And if so, did that prove to be a problem in getting money, or did people want to fund it just because it was so forward-looking?
Well, okay, I didn't explain the problem. The pump plant was originally designed that way, and it was set directly on the river. And because of the silt problems in the wintertime, well, that pump station was filling up with 5 to 6 foot of silt in those pump bays where those pumps were every winter, and then they had to be cleaned out in the spring before you could operate it. So it was a concept of the Bureau of Reclamation that if they would bypass the river further away and from the pump plant and then use the old channel to bring the water back to the plant, and it was really pumping it back up river, or drawing it back up river, that the slowing down of that water and the time it took to get to the pump plant, that they could reduce the sediment by 80%. And this was a real big benefit to the cities, because then they didn't have to try to filter that sediment out. It was already dropped before it got to their pumps. And they made models of this in Denver at their research area, and I saw it there, and so I knew what I was talking about when I went to Washington, D.C. and asked for it. Huh. And it had been demonstrated that it would work. It was implemented, and it does work that well. It works very well in dropping that sediment. And we have never had to pump out those bays since that was put into place.
Oh, because of sediment accumulation,
yeah.
You mean?
Yes. Yeah, we've had to clean out the channel that leads to the pump plant, but we've never had to clean the pump plant itself out.
Right, of course, that would make sense, because that's where that 80% of the sediment's going, is
right
to the bottom of the channel, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned going to Denver. This was to the vendor of the pump system, or the
Bureau of Reclamation. Their political office is in Washington, D.C., but their operational offices are in Denver.
I see. Okay.
And of course, you know, the Bureau of Reclamation has projects in every state west of the Mississippi, mm-hmm. and so. And Denver, well, that's where most of the administration is, and they also have a research center there, and their engineering is basically all in Denver.
Uh-huh. I see.
Yeah.
And so you say you got to Washington with your facts kind of in hand from the Bureau of Reclamation Engineering Department and
yes.
Et cetera. And so then it was, I imagine that made it an easier sell.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. You mentioned now the cities, they get their water then from the same reservoir?
Yes.
The one that's up on the hill there?
Yes. Uh-huh. Now, they also put water in the river from Barney Reservoir, clear up on the Coast Range.
Right.
And they pick it up at the pump plant. They also have water rights out of...
They pick it up at the same pump plant as the...
Right.
As the irrigation.
As the irrigation. And they've got water in the Hague Lake also.
Right.
And they pick their water all up there.
Okay. So the water, the pump plant and the reservoir up on the hill there above Spring Hill Road...
Oh, that reservoir. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's for the irrigation system, right? The one that's up above Spring Hill?
No, there's two up there, one for the cities and one for irrigation.
Oh, I see. Okay, so they don't both draw from the same exact reservoir, but it's being drawn from the same place down below?
Right, from the same place, from the same plant, you know, on the river.
On the river, on the Tualatin.
Right.
Okay, which then would be below where Scoggins flows into the Tualatin.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I get it.
And of course, the cities pump it over to their treatment plant, and then from the treatment plant to their reservoir up on the hill. And that reservoir is about 5 times bigger than the irrigation districts.
Yeah, I can.
And of course, the water all comes from that reservoir then, goes to as far as Beaverton. It can go into Portland all by gravity.
Uh-huh. Again, because of pumping it up the hill there.
Yeah.
And having that 150 pounds of pressure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's 300 feet and you get 1.8 pounds of pressure for every 2 feet, I think. I forget what that figure is, but it comes out to 150 pounds.
Uh-huh.
For every 2 feet you get, or 1.8 feet, you get 1 pound of pressure.
Okay, yeah, that sounds approximately right in terms of the math.
Yeah.
And in terms of, I think we talked about this before, but in terms of irrigation, the water supply at present is adequate for the people drawing on it?
Yes, and the water supply is there. The legislation isn't.
Okay.
The legislation has been quite restrictive, and it was underestimated, and there was no provisions in the legislation to try to meet the. At least balance out the usage of the water. And so there's a lot of water still in Henry Hague Lake that is not being used because the legislation won't allow it.
Uh-huh. So the law needs to catch up with
and it never will, because the environmentalists think that that's a bad deal.
Oh, to draw it all the way down, or?
Well, no, they think any use of water other than to let it flow down the river is not good.
I see. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it would reduce the flows in the Tualatin if you made greater use.
Well, it won't, but they think it will.
Okay. Oh, and why won't it then?
Well, one of the things is that the Tualatin Basin produces 1.5 million acre feet of water. And we're capable right now of putting in reservoirs probably about 70 or 80,000 acre feet. Hardly a drop in the bucket of what's in the runs off of the in the river.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, and
so it has a relatively small contribution to make.
Yes, whether it's flood control or whether it's addition to flows or whatever, it's relatively small.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to say about the irrigation district or irrigation situation?
No, I think I've said everything pretty well.
Okay. Well, I do too. Yeah. And thank you again for a good interview. And we'll get together one more time to sort of talk a little bit more about farming and about maybe just any loose ends that either one of us thinks of between now and then. So thanks again.
Mm-hmm.